alternator. The alternator that is creating the electrical energy coming out of a hydroelectric dam plant, water behind a dam, and it's going through a turbine, and it's turning a shaft. If I only talk about the efficiency of the alternator, the thing that's converting shaft rotational mechanical energy into electric energy that eventually ends up on the grid, that one sub-component of that system, under normal circumstances, please tell me, Gene, what you believe is the achievable efficiency of its converting mechanical rotational shaft energy into electrical energy. What do you believe of that one subcomponent, the alternator all by itself? What efficiency do you believe I can achieve with good design? VE6LCK, KQRIW.
You're talking about magnetic losses in the stators and things like that. The only way you could do that is you'd have to put in materials that wouldn't actually conduct. And even then, you still need them to create help the magnetic field and concentrate the magnetic field. So you still want iron and stuff like that in there. People forget. They think that magnets don't generate power. People don't realize the power we use today is all done either by magnets or something created in magnetic field. But eventually something is there's a magnet that is a fixed magnet that generates, has its own energy, and when you rotate that thing, it puts out some power, it goes to an alternator, gives you a base magnetic field, and you go. That's how it works. But you can never get more than 60%. But waveguide energy is totally different from what you're talking about, because waveguide energy actually directs energy from airwaves and wires. It doesn't really care, as long as the energy gets into the chamber. So you can convert that to any frequency you want, as long as you're willing to bounce it around enough.
Okay, I'm having a little bit of a problem, Gene. You just said 60% efficiency because of magnetic losses of the alternator itself. If I'm running an alternator and I'm getting 100 megawatts of electrical power out of that alternator, and some of the really big ones at a hydroelectric plant, I'm not sure, but I think they come close. Let me say 100 megawatts of electrical energy is coming out of this alternator. If it's running at 60% efficiency, you're telling me something like 40 megawatts, that's even more, but let me call it 40, more than 40 megawatts is being dissipated as heat. Do you really believe 40 million watts of thermal energy is being dissipated in the core magnetic field and wiring of that alternator? I can't believe you could move enough air through that alternator to keep it from melting down with 40 million watts of thermal energy. Therefore, I am challenging the 60% efficiency. It sounds like a much too low number, Gene. VE6LCK, K2RIW.
Well, you know what? You can check the hysteresis losses, but really, with those generators, they have big diodes that shut out the reflected power back to them, and that's where you get your losses. Actually, it's called canceling power. It's like, you know when you make a waveguide in RF to cancel out a signal and it cancels itself out? That's what it does, but it doesn't actually generate heat, okay? Because it's canceled out another energy source. But the fact is that magnetic fields are the only source of energy that these primitive generators use. And if you're using a generator that has a magnetic pliable core or a squirrel cage or something, 50-60% is pretty efficient. And when you think about it, if it's 60% at a million megawatts, that would be, or 100, or 1 megawatt, that would be like 40K kilowatts of power that would be dissipated. But it would be lost, not necessarily as heat. It would be lost in cancellation and magnetic field distortions, as well as heat. So, and still, if you you look at any of those systems, they're still pretty well cooled.
Everything I know about inefficiency tells me that the primary mechanism of any circuit or component that has electrical inefficiency, whether it be radio wave inefficiency or 60 cycle power generating efficiency, only real inefficiency is thermal. If I turn some of that input shaft rotational energy into heat, I've got inefficiency. But if I'm not generating the heat, if the what you believe is inefficiency is being stored as temporary or permanent magnetic field or voltages that are bouncing or whatever, that is not a loss mechanism. It's not an inefficiency mechanism. Are you saying there are methods of inefficiency that are not thermal? I mean, most of what I know about up till now has told me that the only real inefficiency in a system that's being studied as a closed circuit, as a isolated inside of a box system, so to speak, the only way you can waste energy is to turn it into heat. Almost all other kinds of energy, you have the ability to get them back, and therefore it's not a loss. So a 100 megawatt generator with 60% efficiency dissipating 40 megawatts of heat, I think the building would glow white hot at nighttime with 40 megawatts of dissipation. That would power a really big town, just the wasted thermal energy. So is there any mechanism of inefficiency that is not thermal? That's my direct question, Najin. V6LCK, K2RIW.
V6LCK. You know, it's done all the time. Our magnetic forces cancel each other out with no effect because one's positive, one's negative, and they just cancel each other out. They don't actually produce heat. Remember, electric heat is a secondary process from electrochemical and electromagnetic forces. And besides, it's not 40 megawatts. You would be talking about a 100 megawatt generator. If that was a 100 megawatt generator, it would be 40 megawatts of the energy lost within the system, including the burning of fuel and everything else. But the alternators themselves, they could probably get around 8% efficiency if it wasn't for the power feeding back into the system and causing a pushback on the power or cancellation.
I hear what you're saying, Gene, and I think in this particular area, you and I are probably going to have to agree to disagree. Reflected energy that turns into magnetic energy, other than the heat created by that magnetic energy, changing a core magnetic field and eddy currents, which is another thermal kind of loss. Eddy currents, the loss of an eddy current, is, again, thermal. So in the big picture, on a closed system, I don't think you can have loss of energy that is not thermal. As I see it, energy cannot be created or destroyed, only changed in form. If I'm converting mechanical shaft rotational energy into electrical energy, I think there is no other complete closed circuit analysis form of inefficiency other than thermal.
KC2, QIQ.
I think something's got to get hot. Glenn, you got an opinion on this one? KC2 QIQ, K2RIW?
Yeah, actually I do, Dick. I think what he's trying to explain is basically the same thing that you're saying, but it's coming out in different ways. What's happening is all the loss in power generation, you know, from the generator to the load service is in the mean path, the wiring, etc., and that's a resistive loss. In other words, if you look at the transmission lines themselves, there's a loss in the transmission lines. And the issue is if you have reflections in those transmission lines, every time that path has to pass back, in other words, the first time through the transmission path, there's a loss. Then it comes back to the transmission line, there's a loss. And, of course, if there's distortions in harmonics, poor power factor, then those harmonics are passing through the which is not as usable in energy by the load. And, of course, there again, but those harmonics are moving back and forth, and each time are passing through the resistive path of the transmission line. But I think that's what he was saying. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I'm going to agree with that, Glenn. Reflected energy on a lossy transmission system and reflected energy, which is very similar to what we have with our coaxial cable. In the case of our coaxial cable that has 1 dB of loss per 100 feet, when properly matched, you put that into a high standing wave ratio antenna, and the energy is bouncing back and forth between transmitter and your antenna tuner. So it's bouncing back and forth between your antenna tuner and the antenna, and making multiple passes in that 1 dB loss transmission line, you're going to get a lot more than 1 dB of loss. I'm going to agree with that. If I am isolating my analysis to only the hydroelectric generator itself, let me call it alternator, and if I'm only analyzing mechanical rotational shaft energy going into that alternator versus electrical energy coming out of that alternator, I'm looking at the alternator in isolation, all by itself. And I'm not even defining what load I'm connecting to it per se, other than to say I'm eventually going to connect it to the power grid. But if I'm looking at only the alternator, what's your gut feel as to the kind of efficiency of that one component of the system? What do you believe is the efficiency, if I'm smart enough, that I might be able to achieve, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, I'd like to discuss those losses into two sections. One would be the mechanical, which would be the bearings. So in other words, you have bearings inside a generator, and there's some friction on bearings. Not much. I mean, you can, in a really, really good design, I would say that, you know, you can probably get that to a fraction of a percent. And the electrical side, which would be the magnetic coupling between the windings, the magnets, et cetera, to the point that it actually leaves the generator, I'd say you're probably going to lose another fraction of a percent there as well. So I would imagine that your total losses in a mechanical, in a quality one, you know, that like a power company would be using to, in, by today's standards, it could be as bad as 1% of loss or 99% efficiency. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
N2XJN.
Wow. I would have been happy with 93%, Glenn. You're giving me 99% of the alternator section. Wow. Okay. So somewhere between Gene's 60% and somewhere between...
Because that's mechanical losses. But also, too, people forget some of that energy that comes back and bounces back and forth does not have a mixer. All you have to have is two dissimilar metals, right? Two different metals, and that's a mixer. And then you start transmitting another signal and signals, plus, minus, and all that kind of stuff. But remember, every bit of that energy is still energy that came out of your generator.
CYR.
And can I add a comment to that also, Dick?
Yeah, I think the real efficiency here, I'm positive in my feeling that it's higher than the 60% Gene is telling us of just the alternator. I'm not so sure it can be as high as 99% that Glenn is saying. I think somewhere between those two numbers. I'd settle for 95% if you know what I mean. But considering the amount of energy in megawatts coming out of that alternator and the amount of cooling that I don't see, I mean, I don't see them forcing extremely high power water or oil through the windings of that alternator to keep it from melting down. I don't think they're doing that at the Niagara hydro generating plant. I think those generators are running very close to the numbers that that Glenn is telling us about. Now, whether or not that energy is reflecting on the power grid lines themselves is, in my opinion, a secondary effect, because if you've done a really good job on the way you're running your Niagara generator, the alternator section itself, it is, let me pick a number, a nano-ohm or a pico-ohm of impedance when the grid is a much, much higher impedance. Therefore, any reflected energy sees a short circuit at that alternator and gets re-reflected forward. Yes, it does add to the inefficiency of the grid. And can you do a perfect impedance match at each one of your substations is another very interesting question. And I suspect they can do that. I think a well-designed, adjustable substation can create a very good impedance match for that particular community that is the load for that substation. That's what I believe. There was another person who just signed in. What was your call letter, sir? K2LIW?
Did it work then, sir? Excuse me.
The 8.9 efficient because of mechanical loss.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. 8.9 efficient. All right. We've got some slight disagreements of opinion here. Now, to answer some of Wes's other questions, microwave waveguide, plasma, we sort of touched on that. Circulator, we...
Say it one more thing, though?
Yeah, go ahead, Glenn.
I didn't want to hammer the point, but when you look at power transformers that are on the grid, that are, you know, basically taking the distribution voltage and then knocking it down to, say, consumer voltage that comes into the house, at 60 cycles, the efficiency of those transformers is, there again, like in the 99 percentile in terms of efficiency. But now when you put reactive loads on the other side, the problem that the transformer has is that you can have a bad power factor. And the bad power factor isn't just the difference between sine waves with a phase angle. It's the wave shape distortion, which actually causes a harmonic distortion on the power line. And the frequencies that are outside of 60 cycle do turn up as losses back in the transformer. And here again, bad matches on transmission lines going back to the generator do get absorbed as resistive losses in the system if they keep on getting reflected back and forth in terms of bad power factor or bad waveform generation. So, and those losses do get distributed over the wires, the transformers, and back even into the generator in some spots in terms of bad reactants. But those losses can be fixed with good power factor. That's why the power companies really don't like to generate power to bad power factor, because the power company actually loses that energy that they can't get out to the loads. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I'm going to agree with that one. Yeah, if you have a significant power factor, like if you're running a whole lot of magnetic machinery, you know, rotary machinery that's doing punch pressing and things like that, you're going to be putting capacitor banks of power factor correctors in your plant, because if you don't do it, your local power company is going to charge you a premium, depending on what your power factor is. They're going to charge you an extra charge, and the dollars are going to drain on you, and you're not going to like it. And that's deflected energy, because you're creating harmonics, because you've got an inductive load on, say, rotary machinery that you didn't correct. Now, that inductive energy, which is a phase shift, reflected back through the grid to your alternator, to your hydro generator in my case, I've heard of cases where that reflected energy becomes a kind of system resonance where you literally end up twisting the shaft, cyclically twisting the shaft in a torsional manner on the alternator feed assembly back at the hydro plant. And you can create a mechanical fatigue failure by that reflection resonance-like phenomena. And therefore, I'll bet you there are kinds of load conditioners, electronic circuits, that have been put into power-generating systems which are trying to correct for that. Is that somewhat true from what you know, Glenn? You heard of power conditioners that try to stop any system resonance that can create cyclic torsional loading of the shaft of the alternator? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Absolutely, Dick, and you know I designed them. So, and the funny part about that is many times people look at those circuits and they say, well, aren't those losses themselves? That because, no, those devices actually have, you know, power losses. And people are like, we could get higher efficiency if we take them out. I'm like, oh, believe you me, you need them. And actually it does improve the overall efficiency, because bad harmonics on the power line and the frequencies sometimes can get, just even due to certain rectification circuits and other things, can really get up there and cause a lot of havoc. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
You know what? I have family that works. Yeah, let me get in on this 4A here a little bit. This is Victor Alpha 6. Lima Mike, Victor Alpha 6, Lima Mike in Edmonton. The name here is Les, Lima Echo Sierra. By the way, the other guy, V6LTK,
is by far the most efficient at pretty close to about 95% efficient, but you know, they're using a ratio which is electric power in an electric power plant is defined, or the efficiency is defined as the ratio between the usable electricity output from the generating unit in a specific time and the energy value of the energy source applied to the unit in the same time period. And some efficiencies, just as a comparison, a large hydroelectric plant will give you a good 95% efficiency. Tidal power is closer to 90%. Small hydroelectric plants, 90%. And then you get down to something like a coal-fired power plant is only something like 45% efficient. So those are some of the comparisons. So you guys are right with what you're talking about, VE6 Lima Mike.
VE6 Lima Mike and the group K2RA, that'd be very fine list. And that sounds quite reasonable. Yeah, in the case of coal-fired, your real inefficiency is what I call the Carnot cycle, converting the thermal energy of the burning coal into mechanical energy. I'm calling it a Carnot cycle. If you were doing it with a piston engine or doing it with a turbine, is somewhat similar. And there you do get a significant amount of loss, and it's hard to correct for that. But once you finally converted the coal thermal energy into mechanical energy of rotating turbines, and now that shaft energy you apply to the alternator, I think you're suggesting 95% or so. Glenn think it might be 99, but it's some very high number. A well-designed alternator can do that. And now you would like that alternator to feed the grid in an impedance-matched manner by way of your power company forcing each of the customers to have a low power factor. And you can hit them in the head, your customers, with extra premium charges if they don't achieve that. So they're going to have power factor correctors, conditioners, power conditioners in their plant to correct the power factor. So now you stand the chance of your power grid substation achieving a reasonably good impedance match between that grid and that particular community being fed, or that set of power companies, that set of industrial companies. That set of industrial companies fed by that particular substation. So I think you could look at the substation as a kind of antenna tuner. It's almost an antenna tuner. It's the 60 cycle equivalent of an antenna tuner. It really is creating a kind of an impedance match between the high impedance half megavolt grid and the, let me call it 440 volt, three-cycle, three-phase energy coming out of that substation. So I think that is a kind of impedance match. And now the only thing left to make sure is that you don't have reactive power. And now, without reactive power, I think that system can have not a great deal of reflected energy. Am I being overly naive on this one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
You're right on with that, Dick. 100%. KC2QIQ.
Well, at least I got one guy to agree with me. But I keep paying him, and he keeps agreeing. So there's a little bit of collusion going on there. Very fine, Glenn. Wes's next question, question number three is, what is waveguide deformation? If I take a waveguide that previously was working very well, and I walk up to it with a sledgehammer, and I dent the side of a waveguide, or correspondingly, if I take a coaxial cable, and the coaxial cable is running from the bow to the stern of this great big tanker, a 1,000-foot-long tanker, and some of the load inside the tanker shifts, you know, it's got a great big package, and 500 feet downrange, the load shifts, rams up against the side of the tanker, in between bulkhead number 10 and bulkhead number 11, and squeezes that coax cable, pinches it. In either case, I'm getting a local impedance perturbation. In the case of the waveguide where I put a dent in it, depending on whether I put the dent in the broad wall or the dent in the narrow wall, I'm changing the impedance of the waveguide in that area. If I'm putting the dent in the broad wall, I'm lowering the impedance of the waveguide. If I put a dent in the narrow wall, I'm raising the impedance of the waveguide as long as I didn't make the dent so far that I'm now going into waveguide beyond cutoff. You've got to make sure the waveguide stays at least a half wavelength wide in width in order for the signal to go down. Let me drop. In the piece of the case of the coaxial cable where I pinched it by a shifting box that squeezed the cable, as long as I didn't squeeze the cable so bad that the center conductor comes in direct contact with the outer conductor, as long as I didn't create a short circuit, the fact that I squeezed the cable down means that the 50-ohm cable before the dent becomes, let me pick a number, of 25-ohm impedance in the vicinity of the dent. And the next thing for you to figure out is how many wavelengths long is the dent, whether it be the waveguide or whether it be the coaxial cable. In either case, you've got a change in impedance, and you've got some number of wavelengths of the length of that damaged section. At first, you would think everything's going to stop working. You'd be amazed how much many transmission lines can tolerate that. I personally have done an experiment where I'm taking a half kilowatt transmitter at 432 megacycles. I'm taking a piece of very ratty old RG8 coaxial cable in the shack. I pick up a set of vice grip pliers, and I start squeezing down on that cable just to see what happens. And I've got a bird watt meter on the far side of the cable where I'm squeezing it. Let me drop. And one of the things that I discovered is that I can squeeze that cable with the vice grip pliers. As long as I didn't squeeze it to the point where the center conductor conducts, makes a short circuit with the outer conductor, I can squeeze it down to, let me pick a number, 30%, 25% of its previous diameter in that section where I'm squeezing it with the vice grips. As I said, I was doing this at the half kilowatt level, and I'm watching the power output on a bird watt meter while I'm doing that. I was amazed how much the bird watt meter showed nearly continuous power flow. The transmitter itself sensed a little bit of impedance variation. I could readjust the tuning and loading controls, and I could come back very close to the same power output. That's the good news. The bad news is that at the half kilowatt level with RG8 cable, if I ran a key down for 10 minutes, the cable itself would come up to, let me pick a number, 20 or 30 degrees of temperature rise Fahrenheit. The cable runs at least good and warm. In the places where I'm squeezing it, it ran hot. There's a lot higher current flowing in that area. There's a lot more dielectric loss of the squeezed down section. However, what really happens to the impedance, you study this on a Smith chart or the mathematical equivalent of a Smith chart, well, maybe it's a 20th of a wavelength. So a 20th of the wavelength of the transmission line, I'm squeezing it down to 25 ohms of impedance, but I'm only doing it for a 20th of a wavelength. You go to a Smith chart and you do that as a three-step process. I've got 50-ohm cable coming out of the transmitter, hitting a 1-inch section of 25-ohm cable, in my example, followed by another length of 50-ohm cable. You study that on a Smith chart, and you'll find repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel. You study that on a Smith chart, and you'll pleasantly be surprised to find out that the input impedance to the input end of that cable, when it had a good load at the very far end, used to be 50 ohms. Now, because you created that squeezed down section, but you've only done it as bad as 25 ohms of impedance, you've created a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio in the place where you have squeezed it with the vice grip pliers. There's a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio there, but the 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is only a 20th of a wavelength long when I include the velocity factor of the cable. The net result is that the transmitter used to see 50 ohms. He's now seeing 48 ohms of resistive component, and he's seeing a little bit of reactive component. Maybe he's seeing 3 ohms of capacitive component and 48 ohms of resistive component. He's seeing something like a 1.2 standing wave ratio. The mathematics may not be right, but you can see what's going on. If the length of line that I'm squeezing starts approaching a quarter wavelength in length at the operating frequency, now all hell breaks loose. A quarter wavelength of squeezed down section now gives you an impedance inverting situation. In other words, I've got a 50 ohm load at the far end of the squeezed section. The squeezed section is 25 ohms, so at that interface, there is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Therefore, at the input end of the squeezed down section, The 25 ohms just became multiplied to, I think it's 100 ohms, and now you've got 100 ohms feeding the 50 ohms. You're going to see something like a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Maybe it's even more than that, but you're going to see something big. The way impedance inverting takes place with a quarter wavelength of cable makes that a really bad thing. If I now exaggerate it even further, if I squeeze it down for a full half wavelength, all of a sudden I come back to where I was in the beginning, if you know what I mean. Half
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout.
N2XJN.
A half wavelength of cable will give you the exact same impedance at the output end and the input end, even though it itself is highly mismatched. If I make that squeeze down section a half wavelength long, and it's 25 ohms because I've squeezed it, but I got 50 ohms going in and 50 ohms going out of the squeeze section, believe it or not, I'll have a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. I will get some extra loss because of what I've done to that cable where I'm squeezing it. So squeezing it for a very small number of wavelengths has very little perturbation. As you approach quarter wavelength, the perturbation starts becoming huge, but if I then keep doing it, and now the squeeze down section is a half wavelength long, it starts coming back to 50 ohms again, at least at that one frequency. So that transmission line characteristic, that crazy characteristic of transmission lines, is reasonably true whether you do it with coax cable or waveguide. So just because somebody is giving you a great big long length of very good Andrew Heliac, 7/8 inch long Andrew Heliac, it's a 100 foot long length, and there's one dent in the center where somebody dropped a tool on it, and he's created this one dent. You've got the option of measuring the standing wave ratio, input and output. You've got the option of putting a time domain reflectometer on it. Let me drop. You can put a TDR on it and find out how bad it is. You can tell him, because he's selling it to you, that, hey, that's terrible. I'm only going to give you half of the price that you think you're going to sell it for. And if he accepts that, you've got a deal. But if he forces you to pay 90% of the price of the cable that he would have charged you without the dent, believe it or not, you might be getting a good deal. As ugly as that cable might look with the dent, your first question to yourself is going to be, how bad is the dent? How many wavelengths long is the dent at my operating frequency? And can I correct it? You could go over there with your vice grip pliers and squeeze in the opposite direction and maybe take out most of the dent. In the absolute worst case, you chop it off there and put in a union, you put in a coupling device to get rid of the damaged section. But you'd be amazed how many times a person sees a damaged section, he thinks the cable is terrible and never usable forever, and you'd be amazed how many times the cable is very usable. So don't turn down an ugly-looking piece of coax cable. Let's see what Wesley... We've gone through questions number 1, 2, and 3 so far of Wesley's questions. N2XJN, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Thank you very much, Dick. I basically completely misinterpret my question. It's not that I don't know what is the wave guide information, and that's what I was asking for. But also, it is not the negative, but it's the positive for the center of touch and technology of airport, and it says that it is one of the promising techniques of waveguide deformation for the weaponry. But the second thing that you actually didn't let me say, let me jump. Okay, actually, in the article in Reg, you see that I'm mentioning exactly this factor. I have to agree with the gentleman from Canada to the point of his interpretation. In terms of the circulator could go very, very low with the frequencies. It depends what you understand by the circulator. You can have a few examples. One of them is antenna. A power generator is connected to port 1, the antenna to port 2, and so form of the power of the signal level indicates that there is to point 3. And the signal level at the point 3 is proportional to the transmission loss and should be minimized by tuning the antenna matching network. At that point, you don't have a heat dissipation, and the magnetic field, the part of the electromagnetic field, the magnetic part, is actually canceling itself. Another way of doing that is, just understanding that nuclear reactor is the natural choice for the matching in tune. So let's say, one thing for sure, at low frequency you don't use ferrite and you don't use magnet. Let me give you the example. With the simple amplifier, with the signal source connected to port 1, the amplifier inputs or outputs to port 2, and the signal analyzed to port 3, the amplifier is tuned to the maximum return loss by adjusting for minimum signal to port 3. And the higher return loss is synchronized with the good VSWR, since very well matched amplifier will return as a reflection with very little of the input signal. So, I could go on and on with this. But yes, you can have a circulator working with one megahertz frequency. And another thing is, plasma in circulator. Plasma in circulator. Since when we know the frequency we're dealing with, the size of the circulator, the higher and higher. Now, when you have a circulator that has the evacuated environment, then you don't have a heat. A heat can occur only if you have any kind of matter over there. Of course, you say, well, we have an electron that are circulating. Yes. But then if you have a right and left movement or let's say acceleration, and then you utilize the magnetic field for it, the dissipation of energy comes from the magnetic part of the electromagnetic field. Therefore, there is no heat problem in it, as you say.
I think you're suggesting, and maybe you're not, that a plasma with magnetic field can be used as a medium for a circulator. I'm a little skeptical on that one. I wouldn't say it's impossible, but controlling it could be extremely difficult because it's in general, a negative impedance. However, you did say something else that's rather good, and that is, when it comes to a unilateralizing device, the circulator is intended to be a unilateralizer. You want the signal to flow in one direction, but not be able to come back to that transmitter, so to speak, and a circulator supplies that. An active circuit acting as a unilateralizer, a circuit that has an input connector and an output connector, a real amplifier, does a beautiful job. I mean, a real good amplifier could have a reverse voltage characteristic, reverse voltage transfer characteristic that could easily be minus 20 or minus 30 or minus 40 dB if you're willing to use an amplifier in that manner. But it's the amplifier itself that we want to protect. So I know we're going to be cut off pretty soon, so I'm going to tell people before we get cut off that this was TechNet number 1,398 of the TechNets that began in September of 1982, 29 and a fraction years ago. Whenever you want to listen to any of the TechNets, most of them are available at the website of www.amateurradio.tangovictor, amateurradio.tangovictor, and you've got a little bit of a problem of sometimes the most recent recording might not be available. In other words, it may be an empty file until it gets corrected downrange. I think somebody is talking to me right now.
project. I think it went very well. We got some good.
Thank you. Mother's Day was nice. see a lot of colleges and stuff are graduating now, Brian. When do the high schools on Long Island get out? Do they public schools get out sometime beginning of June or end of June? Back to you.
Well, they're going to get out generally around the 21st or the 20th of June. I have in my junior high schedule, we have finals the second and half of the third week of June. But my regular teaching schedule is kind of going to be changing this week, but more so next week. We're pretty much finished with the 8th grade instrumental, except for we're taking the band to NISMA majors, so the band's going to be playing on the June 6th. But I just have a few lessons that teach there, but it's pretty much wrapped up, and then the high school will be wrapping up with their lessons this week and next week. So, and then I just have a couple of general music classes, 7th grade, that has to be done by the 7th, 8th of June with finals, and, you know, final exam, playing exam, and so on. So I'll be basically in stages, my schedule's wrapping up over the next couple of weeks, and definitely by the first week of June. Private schools are usually done in the first week of June. You see around the second or the first or the fourth or something like that, depending on the private school. Back to you, Ted.
Hey, C2IDT Mobile.
We got a K2IDT in there as well. We'll turn it over to him in a minute. You know, back in the 60s when I went to junior high was the 7th, 8th, and 9th grade, so I'm curious if that's still the same now. Breaking station, go ahead and pick it up.
Yeah, hi there, guys. It's KC2, Yankee Delta Tango here. I'm just heading to the hospital now. Back to good old work a little bit. I had a really, really rough weekend up in Greenwich, New York all week. Weekend, looking for 18-year-old mentally handicapped kid with mental capacity of a 4-year-old that didn't turn out the way we would have liked it, but that's life.
And to UZB.
UZB.
Okay, not recognized, W2SC Mobile and Matt, good morning to you, nice to hear you. I'll pass over to Knopf. Now if you can pass it over, Ted, K1UFM. And fine, Matt, that you had a good week. I'm glad everything went well, and we'll, you know, it was good for us if you were listening a little bit there, and kind of busy with my cousin visiting from Denver, and Friday, and then my birthday celebration on Saturday with my sister and her family. And so it sounds good. Plan on going to the hospital, and I think the mothers really had a great weekend there all the way through. For Father's Day, we all know it's mostly barbecues, right? So the restaurants really don't have that big a deal on Father's Day like Mother's Day. You really have to have your reservations in, and the restaurants were pretty packed yesterday, that's for sure. So, Knopf, over to you, and then it goes over to Ted, W2SCT Mobile. How was your weekend? Now that you settled back from Las Vegas.
Good, I said it wasn't a great weekend. I was up in Greenwich all weekend searching for 18-year-old mentally handicapped person who the results didn't turn out good at all. Tom?
Yeah, it was... Well, a little bit of a difficult weekend. We had coming up on the Hebrew anniversary of my mother's death on the Jewish calendar this week, and we had the monument put up on her grave. So we had, I guess you could call it, a graveside ceremony, and my brother came in from England, and my sister came in from Baltimore, and a few of my brother's kids came, my sister's kids came, some of them, and some of her daughter-in-law, son-in-law, two son-in-laws then. And then we went out to eat afterwards. And, you know, it was the first time we had all been together since about 9 months. Because my brother lives overseas, and we don't get to see him that often. And probably less so now that both my parents are gone. We had a nice meal in a restaurant and so on. A little draining, and my wife was being a little bit difficult. just privately to me, not to the rest of the family. I think it goes to, forgot who it goes to.
One U.S. I'm fine. Welcome back from Vegas, Doc. Now that you're back, you better go online and check your card balance to make sure somebody didn't get hold of your numbers and run your card on you. Vegas is famous for that. I'm 1 minute away from the company parking lot and a free cup of coffee. So I'll say 73, gentlemen, and over to you. I believe it's over to, not sure if it goes to Peter. You pick it up, Peter. 73, K1UFM.
All right, Ted, K1UFM, W2S. All right, have a good morning and enjoy it. And we'll catch you later on. Hopefully tomorrow that you're back on regular schedule here. Here you're with your, what was going on with your family last week. I don't know what happened on the last go-around. I turned it over to Noth, and then Matt was talking, so I don't know what happened there. I picked it up, and then Noth called in. I turned it over to him, so I don't know, but very good Noth. We caught pretty much everything, part of what Matt said. And so I guess I'll turn it over to Matt next, and then around to Noth. It's fine, and on a nice get-together there on the anniversary of her passing. And how long ago was that, Noth? Was that a couple of years ago, or I wonder how long ago? But it seems like it was nice to get the whole family together. Yeah, your brother lives over in London, so it's kind of hard getting everybody together that often. So so that's good. Commemorating Mom, and sounds like a nice gathering there for sure. And so Matt, over to you. W2SC Smolder on the group.
Yeah, Peter, I was just correcting you. You completely misunderstood what I said. I said there wasn't a great weekend at all. I was upstate all weekend looking for an 18-year-old mentally handicapped kid, but the results turned out really, really negative. So, but I'm on my destination, so 7th of July, Peter.
Okay, I think it goes to me. Let me drop it and make sure. Okay, I guess it does. Sorry to hear about that, Matt.